Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This episode of Pardes Live and Miniseries features Rav Mike Foyer. For more information on how to download more podcasts, visit elmod.pardes.org.
All right, good morning, everybody. So, a question already? I didn't say anything. You know, as I was writing it, I had the same question of why I put quotes on it. I think because it's a little bit pretentious to talk about right consciousness, so therefore I put it in quotes to make myself feel better. That's really the honest answer. It was a psycho-emotional response to not being Rav Kook and yet asserting things without any sources. If you've noticed, Rav Kook has a tendency to do that. But that's a great segue into what I want to do today. I know, it's all in quotes. Right? You call me out. I actually don't trust myself to just say things. You can't hear the verbal quotes because they're in my head. I feel so connected. But yes, I think I'm also recording. Yeah, thank you for checking. Let's make sure the hold is on there. Yeah, so this is what I'd like to do today. I just want to briefly touch these three categories again because, does anybody not have the sources? I brought some extras. You also need? Okay, here we go. Conveniently provided by Deborah. Yeah, I think so. You guys have? You have, Chad? That's okay. So I want to briefly touch this framework from the source on the fourth page that we were working on the last two classes, just to use it, to keep it in the back of our minds, so to speak, as we now delve into the major portion of what I would like to do, which actually begins on page one. It reminds me why I started there. And God willing, that will take us probably the next couple of classes, which I think is all we have.
One more class.
This one and the next one,
yeah.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right, so we'll see where we end up. It's always hard to know. Okay, so remembering that in the piece that we looked at in the beginning, first two classes, Rav Kook laid out three different categories of tshuva. Right, and I'm not going to do the full review, but I do want to have in mind. First was this notion of tiv'it, right? And it's, you know, natural tshuva. It was the sickness model of sin, right? This idea that just like if you eat bad things, it's going to make you ill. So too, you do bad things, and you are going to feel it, right? And so therefore, the actual suffering a person experiences is the sign that of ill health, and tshuva is sort of founded on this notion of yosher, of natural rectitude. Remember I quoted to you guys that pasuk from Kohelet that he's really playing with in several places in that text, that God made man straight. It's Kohelet 7:29, right? God made man straight. Behema bikshu cheshbonot rabim. They sought out a bunch of complications, right? This is what we call overthinking life, right? And that's why if anybody's ever tried to get a grip on their diet, for instance, it's actually, on the face of it, quite simple. Don't eat this, eat that, eat less than you do, maybe change the times of day. It all looks very easy. What's the hard part? Actually doing it, right? Which leads to what the model of tshuva is, we said, was extreme ownership. Right? This sense that if a situation is natural, then it's built in that I should be able to do it. Right? I gave you guys that the borrowing from Jocko Willick, that notion of extreme ownership, that basically, that if you want to be well, listen to your body and be well, right? And he put this as a general principle. We're going to return to it, but that's kind of the foundational level of tshuva. And let's remember, it's based on what we would call an optimistic view of the human condition. Right? There were a couple of challenges to that, and the question, he did point out that one could lose that natural rectitude due to the complications of life, but nevertheless, it's fundamentally an optimistic view of humanity, which is consistent with Rav Kook. He's definitely, I would call him, a spiritual optimist. The next level that he laid out for us was this tshuva emunit, a faithful tshuva, which he didn't delve too much into, but the basis there was that we have mesorat vedat. There's a received tradition and something we call religion. And he talks about how the prophets and the Torah, everything is filled, full, with not only commandments, but also the promise that tshuva works. Now, why do the two have to come together? First of all, without the commandments, this is now sin as a deviation from the plan. That's what only half a quote there. Next, we're going to psychoanalyze that one later, right? There's some externally revealed plan, divine plan, and tshuva becomes a deviation from that, right? Meaning there are, even in classical thought, the notion that the mitzvot break down into what are often called sort of chok u'mishpat, that mishpatim are the mitzvot that even if God hadn't commanded them, they would have been sort of logically derivable, like don't murder is a good foundation for a happy civilization. Whereas you probably would not have decided on your own not to mix wool and linen. That wouldn't have occurred to you, right? So there are the idea is that those two together create a framework which allows a human being to enter into a higher level of relationship and therefore a higher level of selfhood. It's another piece that we can't delve into completely together, although it will come up for us again today. This idea that Rav Kook is living in a tension between this notion of ein od milvado, that in the Hasidic sense, that there is nothing other than God, as opposed to the simple reading of that pasuk, which is there is no God other than the Lord. Right? There's a deeper reading of it, which comes from the Kabbalists and becomes popular amongst the Hasidim, that actually there is nothing other than God. It's what the philosophers call acosmism, right? Which, of course, he's living in tension with that. Why? Existence, right? Meaning, I mean, I woke up this morning, I'm fairly convinced that I exist, right? But even in a deeper sense, a theological sense, that lives in tension with what we call brit, right? The fundamental model of the Torah is a brit. It's a covenant. A covenant happens between two people. Therefore, it's ridiculous on the face of it to think about God having a brit with God's self. So Rav Kook, and it runs through his writings in my humble experience, this tension between the sort of the absolutism of God, and therefore the only reasonable spiritual response is the negation of self, and the fact that the whole Torah is founded on brit, and therefore your actions matter, your individuality matters, etc. So on one hand, we have, and we're going to see a lot of this today, the external will of God, which should be overwhelming, and therefore the highest response to God's external will would be obedience. But then we have the internal will of humanity. So there's a question here. I'm going to put it out there now. We're going to come back to it when we look at today's sources. If, from an emuna standpoint, tshuva involves getting back with the plan, does that really mean the only purpose of human will is obedience? You guys understand the question? In which case, human will would constitute what? Yeah, if, from this perspective, tshuva means God has revealed the Torah, it's got all these rules, it's a plan. Sin means a deviation from the plan, and tshuva means getting back on the plan, which would imply, at least, that the only purpose of human will is obedience. Now, we could complicate that a little bit, but for now, I just want to just note that challenge, which does not work at all with many of the statements that we're going to see from Rav Kook today, one in particular. So I'll return to what I have in my notes here when we get to that, because we're just doing the review. So that's the simple presentation. And there it is important that he notes that tshuva there is not, it doesn't seem to be a natural assumption. I mean, if God says, thou shalt not, what should be the result of disobeying God? Destruction, punishment, something. So meaning it's not obvious that tshuva, right, the assumption of natural rectitude, if I'm healthy, an optimistic sense, and I don't know, eat too much Ben and Jerry's late at night and I feel ill in the morning, well, it's natural to assume that I could just stop eating the Ben and Jerry's and I will go back to some natural state, that and several miles of running, right? So, whereas, it's not necessarily an easy assumption that if God said, here's the plan, don't deviate, once you get off the track, it's not in any way obvious that there's a way back. And that's why he emphasizes that this level of tshuva is based also on a divine promise. As we remember in the text, we saw that the prophets are full of the notion, do tshuva, do tshuva. There's a beautiful midrash, which I'll paraphrase because I don't know it by heart, that essentially someone goes to the Torah, to the prophets, and asks, like, what should we do if we sin? You know, one answer is, well, yeah, sinners should die. The other one's, you know, sinners should be punished. And what's God's answer? Tshuva. Right? So that God's perspective is very different in that midrash than the Torah or the prophets. Which is a question I want to hold for now. We're going to come back to it. Is that why would God make a system where the assumption is obedience, where failure is apparently built in, and he left sort of an out, which is you can always get back. What that you can see, by the way, that might cast a different angle on this question of whether the only purpose of human will is obedience or not. All right. Last but certainly not least was this category that he called tshuva sichlit, the intellectual tshuva, as I translated it. Here, first of all, it's important to note that he said this one emerges, that a healthy body and a faithful heart allow for what he calls hakara brura, a clear consciousness, a right consciousness. You're able to actually recognize the world for what it is. Again, optimistic. The assumption, and this is where we got into his sense of inevitability. Here, we didn't really see inevitability with the natural. He said, yeah, you know, God made man straight, but the truth is, you can mess yourself up. You know, we spoke about one's environment of formation, or, you know, not every disease has a cure, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you don't want to go too far with the metaphor, but, right? And certainly when it comes to faith, there comes a point at which we, you know, everybody likes to turn an ideology out of their bad behavior, right? This is one of the most common practices that we all have, if you've never thought about it, right? This is the Gemara says that a person sins three times and it becomes heter, and it becomes permissible. That doesn't mean that, three strikes and it's okay. It means that once I do something three times, inevitably, psychologically, I will devise some worldview that will tell me it's really okay. We're all looking to turn our bad behaviors into an ideology that will make us feel good about the world. And it makes sense because guilt is not only out of fashion, it's actually not a particularly healthy, you know, healthy posture in life. But here, he's assuming that if you let your body function naturally and you get it healthy and you get with the program, you will now be able to know the world. You have a consciousness of the world, which is fundamentally different and more right. Now, it's not necessarily a moral right. We're going to be careful. We spoke about the distinction between moral and essential language, right? This is right almost in the philosophical sense, because Rav Kook is certainly an essentialist. He believes there is a way the world is. You could complicate that with some of his writings in terms of the fact that the world emerges through our interaction with it, but nonetheless, he is not a postmodernist. So, and therefore, knowing the world is an active, interactive act, but God is definitely the, let's say, the chief author of that process. And therefore, sin actually here is the model of sin is blindness. Sin as blindness, which is interesting because can you blame a person for stumbling if they can't see? And here, we only have a few classes together, but this goes very deeply into Rav Kook's model of what tshuva means for the tzaddikim. Right? What is happening to the world when the righteous are unable to bring to bear this right consciousness and guide the world in learning to see? Right? Because, put it this way, God forbid if you took a baby and you covered its eyes from birth, right? And after, I don't know, 3 years, you unbound its eyes, would it be able to see? The answer is no, meaning it will be able to sense light and perhaps eventually shapes, but the ability to see is developed through usage, and it's connected to the soft wiring of your brain, right? Right? Exactly. So therefore, right, there's a way in which you develop right consciousness through a right interaction with the world. You cannot be expected, if you're still wallowing in sickness or in classic sin, to actually know the world. On one hand, you could say that deepens your sin. On the other hand, how could you possibly be held responsible for something which you do not know? Or not only do not know, but cannot know. So this is a very high level, which we're going to revisit when we get more of these sources today. And that was a quick review. I think I'm going to stop there. Questions or comments? Things people want to clarify before we move on to a new set of sources.
Yeah, I assume that's a comment I'm asking whether this is a comment on growing up in exile.
It's an interesting point. I think that one could make an argument that this maps, I pointed out to you that Rav Kook is always working in three dimensions, at least. The individual, the national, and the sort of creation. Sometimes he sticks humanity in as a separate one. And so therefore, if you wanted to map this out to the national, one could say that this is a return to grounded national existence in the land. This is a return to right religion, the temple, you know, priests, etc. You know what this is? Nevuah. This is prophecy, which is essentially a level of consciousness that Rav Kook believes is intrinsic to the Jewish people and is the expression of our most right national existence. So you see how it could map there, and then begs the question of what humanity looks like there. By the way, I can do it with humanity as a whole as well. Ultimately, this is what we call peace, right? This is the end of idolatry, right? And this is a beautiful vision that comes out in his writings on vegetarianism, where consciousness begins to pervade even the animal world. That's how he understands, say, Isaiah's famous vision, the lion laying down with the lamb, and the predators eating straw, et cetera, et cetera. He has a notion that once humanity is able to make peace with one another, that our responsibility will be to turn our goodness on what he calls our younger brothers. And he has a whole vision of vegetarianism and peace, which is a discussion for another time. So it's a good question. You had a good sense there that there's a structure. He's also a structural thinker in that sense. Even though he wasn't a systematic philosopher, there are definitely structures that one can find in his thought. Other questions or comments before we open up a new text? Okay, great. Stuff comes up. You'll stop me. Throw things. Find the best way. So this is what I want to do. On the first page, the first and second page in the English, and then the second and third is the Hebrew, I've given you the fifth chapter in Orot HaTshuva, in the Lights of Repentance. And I chose it, frankly, because it struck my interest. I mean, it's a long, Orot HaTshuva has, there are many chapters there. It's a worthwhile study. Every year around this time, I make it through one or two other pieces, and then I always tell myself I'm going to go all the way through, and it just never really happens. But next year's a new opportunity for Orot HaTshuva, I guess, right? Okay, so the introduction to this section, it was titled likely by Rav Tzviya, by Rav Kook's son, Hechrechiut Mitziut HaTshuva, right, the necessity of the existence of tshuva, Uhulata ba'adam ba'olam b'kneset Yisrael, and its action or its effect in Adam, in humanity, in the world, sorry, humanity, Adam, I want to say in an individual, in the world, and in Knesset Yisrael. How did I translate it? I'm curious. I said humanity. I'm not so sure I agree with that translation, even though I did it, because I'm sensing here, once again, this three-part structure. Rav Kook, he doesn't actually use the phrase, but I've been taught and have seen that he's always thinking about tikkun atzmo, tikkun am, tikkun olam. This idea that what's a tikkun, by the way? What does that word mean in the sort of Kabbalistic or the sort of the Hasidic language? It's worked its way into popular language. What? Yeah, correction. It's interesting that correction implies that something went off. So there is it is possible, yeah. Healing, meaning something's broken, and notice both of those. There's an assumption that where there was a primordial state of rectitude, and that something went wrong, and that there's some sort of fixing or healing. You know, this comes mostly from the Arizal. From the great mystic master of Sfat, 16th century, who gave us the dominant vision of mysticism today, whether people are familiar with it or not, this idea that we live in a broken world and that all the actions that we do are picking up the shards, like the light, if people are familiar with what's called raising up the sparks, that every act that we do is somehow freeing some element of divine light and doing a tikkun. And what's interesting is that could imply a very static worldview. Right? There was a primordial state. Things got broken. I'm putting it back together. Which begs what question? How to get broken in the first place? Not only how, but why? Meaning I could give you a myth, which the Arizal does give a myth, about how it got broken. Anybody know the myth? So let's start at the beginning. In the beginning there was God. Right? And for some reason, unbeknownst to us, although we were going to come back around to it, God willing, today, God wanted creation. But in order to make creation, you know what God had to create first? What's the first and only thing God created out of nothing? Yes, nothingness. Because in the beginning, there was only God. And in order to make creation, there had to be a space for other. And so the actual act of creation begins with this act of withdrawal, which means that nothingness is the true act of creation. Everything else then becomes, as the Rizal says, one ray of divine light was sent forth. You've got to use that kind of language when you're talking this way, right? Into this void. And there were vessels that God created to receive it. And what happened to those vessels? They couldn't hold it, and they shattered. Right? And this image of the shattered vessels with these little now sparks of light caught up in it, grossly oversimplifying the Arizal, become the world in which we live. And actions done with the right consciousness are able to put the pieces back together. Now, what question comes up right away there? How come the vessels broke? This is not a small question. Unless you think it's just a question on the mythic language of the Arizal, I think we brought up before, I mean, the Bible starts off with God saying to Adam, listen, eat this, don't eat that. And it's literally less than 24 hours until things go wrong. And that becomes a theme. It's like Noah, oh, I regret I did this, we're going to wipe that all out. Oh, the Tower of Babel. Oh, Abraham and et cetera, his children, and the calf, and the first temple, and the second temple. We spoke this out, that one could actually just get the sense that either God is incompetent, which, by the way, would be the idolatrous answer to why God, because God is limited in God's creative capacity, and that's why they broke, right? Or, like Nebuch, humanity just keeps failing, or it begs what question? Perhaps failure is actually not what we think it is. Which is exactly where Rav Kook is going to go today, right? And that's why it's important to remember this idea of tikkun, on one hand, could be there was a primordial state and it's a fixing, but I'm wary of that because it's static. It means that mercy and failure are always second best. It should have stayed the way it was, and it somehow got messed up. And that begs the question for God, how come God couldn't make these vessels? And also begs the question for humanity. You're telling me the best I can hope to is get back to some primordial state and there's no growth, there's no progress, that my failures are just like, the best I can do is try to get back to what I was, right? That's called nostalgia, right? Spiritual nostalgia is not what we're after. Okay, so therefore, what we do? Because there's notice the key word to me in this language is hechrechut, this necessity of the existence of Jew. That's a philosophical assertion, that the world could not exist as the world without tshuva. Now notice the difference. It doesn't mean that God couldn't create a world without tshuva. That's a philosophical question that I'm not interested in. It means the world as we know it is contingent upon the existence of tshuva. You understand? That's what hechrechut means, because God's power is infinite. God could have created a world where there was no tshuva, but you know what it wouldn't be? This world. So he works in reverse. I know what this world is, and I can tell you in order for this world to be what it is, tshuva is necessary. Doesn't mean that God couldn't create a world without tshuva, but it does mean that it wouldn't be this world. Okay, let's go. Tshuva hi hargasha yoter briya shel nefesh. It's the healthiest feeling of the soul. Notice we're going right back to his initial structure. Yeah, a healthy soul and a healthy goof and healthy bodies. Muchechet hi lavo liyidei ha'osha gadol shel tshuva. It's a necessity that will come to this great joy of tshuva. And notice that we're going to see a theme here, as you mentioned before, Avram, when we were talking before class. Rav Kook is really happy about tshuva, which is nice until you think about what's the first step in tshuva? Right, so it just begs this question once again. If failure, sin, breakdown is the first step in this process, I mean, relief that there's a way out, I can understand, but joy, the great joy of tshuva, really? I mean, I don't know about you guys, but there's a little bit of guilt often mixed into my sense of like, okay, I'm sure glad I didn't blow it, but I'm not so happy, you know? And yet, this is not the way he approaches the question, because he goes even further. He mageshet ba et ha'oneg ativia yoter gadol, right? Meaning healthy soul in the healthy body feels in tshuva ha'oneg ativia yoter gadol. What does the word oneg mean? What? Delights, pleasure, right? Pleasure is a very bad name in modern religious discourse. I mean, the Hasidim tried to bring it back, but the reality is, especially those of us who grew up in a Western, even secular, but Christian culture, Christianity has a real challenge with the notion of pleasure. They got a little bit of the Greek notion of intellectual pleasure, but it's hard to overcome a lot of history. So, but what does he mean? And by the way, elsewhere, Cook is really into Oneg. Elsewhere, when I teach this class during the second semester, we focus on Rav Kook's writings on tefillah, and he will say that tefillah is the tanug hachi kasher sheba'olam. Right? It's the most kosher, meaning fit, most fitting pleasure in existence, which when I tell most people who daven three times a day, they laugh in my face. But there's a relationship between the two. What is Oneg? When I say Oneg, what do you think of? Oneg Shabbat, great. By the way, I think I've never had anybody answer anything else in the association game there. So Oneg Shabbat, what's there? You're at an Oneg Shabbat, what's there? Sweets, food, singing, family. Well, you know, that notion of Oneg is definitely physical intimacy, right? Meaning, it's interesting that there's always a physical element there, but you know what I've never had anyone say? That they're alone, yeah. That they're alone. Like, you went family, friends, I mean, the image, singing, you know, it's true. If you gave me a jar of herring and a bottle of bourbon and you left me alone to sing, I'd probably have a really good time on Friday night. But after a while, it would get old, a month or two. Meaning, there's a definition of Oneg which lies behind what Rav Kook is asserting. It's a definition that actually gets its most beautiful expression, in my experience, in Tomer Devorah. If people are familiar with Rav Moshe Cordovero's short but incredibly powerful book, which is seasonal. It's about, it's a book of spiritual practice, which is fit to how one actually acts like God in the world. Tomer Devorah, highly recommended. There's actually a tradition of reading it in the 10 Days of Repentance, because it's got 10 chapters. Tomer Devorah, you want me to write it down? You can find it. There are a lot of English translations out there. The Palm Tree of Deborah. And he describes Oneg as the experience of harmonious existence. And I say harmonious deliberately because that's where there needs to be another person. You can't have harmony by yourself. Right? Because harmony is interaction. Peace, tranquility, yes, but not harmony. I think we could have a semantic argument. But what I mean when I say the world, and word, and as far as I understand it, even the scientific definition, that is it's something which emerges from interaction. Whoever's phone that is, they could please turn it off. This is a critical piece here because tshuva is what gives the experience of oneg hativi hayoter gadol, the greatest possible natural feeling of harmonious existence, right? You do something wrong, and the fact of tshuva, and also, of course, the act of tshuva, gives you a sense of harmonious existence. That's very strange. What I would have thought is, what's my experience of harmonious existence coming from? Not doing things wrong. Why am I getting the deepest sense of harmonious existence of actually out of my failures, even though I'm making good on them afterwards? What do you mean? But how does it get you closer to God? I mean, let's assume...
Because you earned it.
Ah. What do you mean? That you earned it.
I think about that concept
about
the bread of shame.
Yes. I don't know what it is. Hamad Kisufa. It's actually usually in Aramaic. Can I explain it for people who aren't familiar? Right? There's a notion, both in practically in tzedakah and also in spiritual work, that anything which one is given might be good, but that which one earns is a full good, right? This is the idea that you give a man a fish, they eat for a day, you teach them a fish, they eat for the rest of their life. It's not just a practical assertion, it's also a sort of a moral, psycho-emotional assertion that the shame that comes with eating bread which is given takes away from the goodness of the gift, whereas if I teach someone how to take care of themselves, then they earn that which they got, okay?
So the joy is the
Ah, so by the way, notice how this is going to upset the simplistic view of primordial rectitude. That it's not that everything was good and then I deviate and I go back to a state of good. It's that everything was okay and then I deviate and you know what I do? Everything gets better. Now, this is a model I want you guys to keep in mind, because we're going to start to see itself poking itself out more and more in this notion. If you recall, those of you guys who were in the first class, I'll just show you my drawing of the diagram, is that this is the evolutionary model of tshuva. That when the coming to consciousness, which results from sin, anybody here meditate as a practice? Right? As a practice?
Years ago.
So one of the great learning points in meditative practices is when you realize that your mind is drifting. You understand? It's like, I could tell you all to close your eyes right now and focus on your breath, and maybe some people are good at it, maybe some... At some point, unless you've been practicing for quite some time, you're suddenly going to realize that you're thinking about baseball or work or something else. Now, here's the key. If you want to learn discipline in meditation, the moment when you come to consciousness that you've lost focus is the most important moment. Right? Because the question there is what allowed me to step out of the stream of consciousness that took me away from focus, that moment of waking up and realizing, even though now I'm like blowing it, because now I'm not even not focusing on my breathing, I'm focusing on the fact that I'm not focusing. Yeah, but that's how you get back to focus. You understand? That it's called the coming to consciousness. That is the key moment in all discipline. And what Rav Kook is saying is that, okay, I was me, and then I deviated. We could talk about I deviated from the natural, or I deviated from some externally sort of like commanded plan. Doesn't really matter. At some point, right, I did it because I believed it was right. Very few people do things believing that they're wrong. Even if we know, quote unquote, that what I'm doing here is wrong, on some level, I'm justifying it. For instance, we'll go back to my example because it's morally neutral and fun. There I am at 10 at night eating the chubby hubby, you know, Ben and Jerry's ice cream. And part of me is saying, Mike, listen, you're trying to control your weight. Like, you shouldn't be doing this right now. And, you know, a much more visceral and, in the moment, more powerful part of me is saying what? Oh, but it's so good. And not only that, but often, and I deserve it, you know, like I work so hard or whatever the psycho-emotional sort of game which is going on there for me, right? So it's very rare that I'm going to be eating that and saying, this is bad. You know why? Why would I? It's rare that happens? Because it takes away the pleasure out of doing it. And at a certain point, that coming to consciousness of like, oh, actually, whether it's a coming to consciousness I'm going to feel terrible in the morning, or it's coming to consciousness that I have a deep commitment to myself that I don't want to have binge ice cream 10 o'clock episodes, or I'm coming to consciousness myself that if I keep going like this, I'm not going to be around to see my kids get married, or whatever that is, that moment when I'm able to pull out of the action and apply to it a value, a decision, a moral standard which exists outside of the moment, that moment is a moment of evolution. Now, sometimes it doesn't last. And I'll have that realization and I'll fall back to it. But the fact that it's there is the moment of potential growth. So that is a coming into a deeper harmony with who I believe I ought to be, or if I'm focused on the external standard, who God is inviting me to be. And that's why it's actually a deeper harmony, though it comes out of what seems like a deviation. You guys understand the difference? I'm going to say it in more simple terms. If the world were static, and every failure is a fall back, and the only way to improve is to just get back to where I was, then harmony exists before failure. But if the world is dynamic, and there's a growth potential, right, then sin, failure, which provokes a coming to consciousness of, no, really, I actually could be more, enters me into a much deeper harmony with who I believe I could be, who I believe I'm being invited to be by God, or in this intellectual sense, how the world actually is.
And that's what Kumash has cyclical behavior by
it would, that's the positive perspective of that cyclical behavior, because the hope being, I'll give you the example, the book of Judges is quite chaotic, right? And it's the, classically the most cyclical, although the cycle somewhat repeats itself through the book of Kings, right? And what results out of the book of Judges? Kingship, right? Which is always a higher order of organization. Now, the fact that it doesn't last, we can have a whole discussion, meaning that's I would say, the idealistic view of it, right? Because the other sort of way of viewing the cycle becomes self-judgment and failure, which is why Ralph Cook's optimism is so important. Not only is optimism like, I believe you can, what word did he start with, or at least with Tzvi Yehuda in the title here? Not just you can, it will happen. This is an inevitability. But the problem with the inevitability is if it's inevitable, then... Oh, doesn't that promote fatalism? Right? Which, by the way, would go right back to the Nahamad Kisufa. If this is the way the world's going, whether I do it or not, then I haven't earned a thing. This, you hear the tension? There's a tension which is going to map quite well onto the notion that everything is God, and yet my will matters. Right. I mean, one way to deal with that is saying that there's God's perspective and human perspective. Maybe God knows everything and sees everything. It's all inevitable. That's not how I live my life. Good. We're going to come back to this notion. Okay. So just to finish this first little section here, he speaks about how spitting out the, just like, I'll just read it in the words. Pletat chomarim amezikim pula pulata. Right? When you eject sort of like, damaging materials. Maybe I'll just look at my translation instead of translating on the fly for you. Right? When the body's whole, the discharge of harmful substances works a positive effect. Right? Bring on health. If anybody's ever barfed up something bothering them, they know what he's talking about. Right? And then he says, that therefore, when an organism is both spiritually and physically healthy, then there will be this spiritual discharge which occurs as well. And there's a very important phrase he uses. You're emptying out all the wrongdoing, etc., etc., all the wicked thoughts and estrangement from the noble, all-embracing, godly content, that which is the foundation of all evil, all ugliness and crudity. That he's making an assertion here that rihuk, a distancing, right, translated as estrangement, is the source of all evil. Rihuk, yeah. I am on page one, in the section, the first paragraph there, on page one. I know I've been bouncing back and forth between the English and the Hebrew. Even though I did the translation, it just makes more sense to me in Hebrew. But it's very important because this is a theme which runs through his thought and through this section in particular. Rihuk, distance, is the source of all evil. On one level, that makes perfect sense. If I had an imminent sense of God's presence, right, I would be far less likely to disobey God's will. When I'm at home, whatever I've told my kids to do is much more likely to happen than when I ask them to do it while I'm at work. We all know this experience, right? At the same time, this poses a problem with the myth that we started with. If rihuk, if distance is the source of all evil, corruption, failure, etc., then why, oh why, would the first thing that God created be distance and separation? You hear the question? We're just going to leave it as a question for right now, but I want you to keep it in mind. Correct. But there seems to be a rather large price for that. Right? So you're already pushing toward the answer. Right? But we're going to come back to it as we go along. So he goes on. My notes are in the Hebrews. I'll keep flipping back and forth. So, you know, with each piece of ugliness that's removed from the soul through one's inner acceptance of the light of tshuva, notice, it's very interesting. He doesn't say with each piece of ugliness that is removed through fixing your actions. Notice. He says, through acceptance of the light of tshuva, which begs the question, what is this light he's talking about? Again, there's a difference. He could have said, you deviated from your natural, from your imuni or sikhi, And therefore, every time you fix your behavior and get back to where you were, there's some sort of improvement. That's not what he's saying. He's saying every time that you remove this evil from you. And how does that happen? Through your acceptance of the light of tshuva. That somehow it's the ability to return. It's a deeper haskamato is not just haskama. Haskam is an agreement, right? It's not just an intellectual recognition. It's an acceptance of the fact that perhaps tshuva is foundational and not accidental. What do I mean? If I say to most people, it happens to me a lot when I'm doing counseling work, that you need to have rachmanut on yourself. These people all the time. You have to rachmanut. Rachman, you have to be merciful with yourself. Most people hear that as you're telling me to let myself off the hook. Right? And intrinsically, it could just be a Western thing, I don't know, but the driven nature of our society is such that most often, not everybody, but most often people will fight with me. Like, no, like, you know, if I let myself off the hook and then I'm going to have mercy on myself and you know, and then I won't get this done and I won't get that done, I'm just going to sit on my duff and watch TV all day or whatever it is, right? It's very interesting to me because there's a deep assumption there that mercy is a sign of failure. That the only reason mercy exists is because I've failed. So therefore, if you preload the notion I have to be merciful with myself, I'm setting up failure. You understand the logic? I've heard this so many times. What? Yes, it's premised on what I think is a deeply flawed theology, and frankly, I'll be more honest, a Christian theology, which is that we live in a failed world which ought not have been. Original sin. By the way, we have a story of original sin too. Read the Bible. It's there, right? The difference is it begs the question, since we believe that God created the world for a purpose other than to be abandoned, so it begs the question of what do we do with failure? Since it's a story of failure, there's no way around that, at least on the surface of it. And I think the answer is bound up with how you define rachamim. How do you define mercy? The word itself has what three-letter root? Rechem, which means what?
Womb.
Means womb. Rachamim is not a bidi'eved. It's not a post facto nebuch. You should have done what was right. You couldn't, and now I'm going to have mercy on you. Right? A rechem is making space for another to come to be. It's a recognition that in order to come to be, life is a process. And part of that process, you know what when you say I'm in process, you know what that's a code word for? Failing. Well, that's also a thing. But it means if you accept the fact that life is a process, you are accepting the role of failure. Because if life weren't a process, it would mean you're already there, you know? Which means you have that. So you understand how profound this is? Because it goes right back to making space in order for other to be. Where have we heard that already this morning? Yes, that's the essence of the Arizal's mythic language, that God first creates space into which other can be. But then we say, God, have mercy on me. Does God have mercy on me mean, God, Nebuch, I'm a failure, and if it weren't for the fact that you're merciful, I ought to be eliminated because I was once perfect and now I've blown it? You hear how negative that theology is? Right? Whereas the other way to say that is, God, I'm not there yet. And the fact that is my failures are the very things that can allow me to be the person I am not yet. Right? Now that takes mercy because it needs belief. If you're a judge, nobody here is a judge, are they? I've had judges in my class before. It's always important to ask, right? Right? If you're a judge, I worked with at-risk youth for a couple years in a wilderness therapy program. I've had this experience many times, right? I can look at this kid who broke his math teacher's nose with a glass orange juice bottle, right? Rather than paying attention to class, true story, right? And if I'm the judge, I just take the snapshot. How old are you? What did you do? What are the sentencing guidelines? Goodbye. Right? That's called justice. Justice is always the snapshot view of existence. Coming up on Rosh Hashanah, it's worth thinking about. What is mercy? Mercy doesn't mean, Nebuch, but I'm going to send the kid to jail. It's really rough. By the way, youth prison in North Carolina where I was working, 80% recidivism rate. They call, you know what they call it? Training school. No, it's literally called training school. It's training for jail, right? So, but what's mercy in that situation? Judge says, well, but where did this kid come from? And then what's his background? How did he end up in a situation where he even occurred to him to throw a glass bottle at his teacher in the middle of class? Furthermore, where's he going? Not only where's he going, like if I send him to training school, I'm just fast-tracking him to jail, but like, do I see potential in him? Where could he go if? That's called mercy. You get out of the snapshot and you put into the context, right? And that's a completely different view. Now you understand how this speaks to Rav Kook's definition of tshuva? If tshuva is about I fell away from what I should have been and my only hope is to get back to what I ought to have been, then mercy is only a recognition of failure. And therefore it's bidi'evid, it's post facto. It should never have existed, but Nebuch, since I couldn't keep up with whatever God wanted from me, so, and then you're never going to feel good about tshuva. Why would that ever feel good? But if you are maskim, if you recognize that the light of tshuva indicates something true about the world, which is actually your failures are an indication of your growth. Now, that doesn't mean you're off the hook because we all know that some of us fail and don't grow. It does happen too. But he's an optimist, right? And he believes in you, in me, in the world. And therefore he says, so if you agree that the fact is that I failed, yes, and by the way, it's sin and he believes in reward and punishment. He's a from Jew, as we say. And nevertheless, he doesn't believe, like, why would God create a world where there were just rules that are meant to whack you when you get out of line? Like, what is the point of that? Right? The only point of it, and anybody who's ever been an educator or a parent or a good friend or a spouse knows what the point of it is that you show people the boundaries in order in hopes that they grow. Whether it's because they're now earning their behavior or something slightly even deeper on the same line that he's gonna speak to soon. So that's how I understand. He says that every piece of ugliness is removed from the soul through your inner acceptance of the light of tshuva. The ugliness doesn't go away through changing your behavior changes, but the imprint of it goes away through accepting the fact that this is actually the purpose of existence. I didn't just fail. My failure itself is an opportunity for growth. So worlds filled with the highest clarity are revealed there. That's how, notice he says, you didn't just get rid of that ugliness and get back to where you were. The removal of that ugliness, the changing of your behavior after the failure, reveals something much deeper and more profound. Worlds of, as he says, right, filled with the highest clarity. Clearing away sin is like removing a barrier from one's eyes. A whole horizon of sight is revealed, illuminated with the expanse of heaven and earth and all they contain. Notice, right, clearing away sin is learning to see the world. Right? If we could really see the impact of our actions, then we would change them, correct? But there's a lingering in that notion, the whole, if you're willing to do the time, then you're willing to do the crime. Like, okay, maybe, but I could just do what's called cheshbonut. I could just say, the truth is, yeah, I know that's going to hurt a lot of people, but it's really worth it to me. You know what? It's worth it to me. It's worth it to me to rob the store. It's worth it to me. Or yeah, I know I'm killing myself when I eat that Ben & Jerry's, but man, it's good. Right? That's not enough. What he's saying is if you really knew who you were, this is what's called the Musar of Gadlut. So if you really knew who you were, if you could see the horizons within your selfhood, you simply wouldn't act that way. Not because of fear of punishment or even the consequences of others. Simply, it's not who you are. There's a much greater world both within you and around you. Right? Like I said, it's spiritual optimism. And that's why, by the way, the fact that he believes that world exists is that he goes on. It's inevitable the world come to complete tshuva. Now notice, he says it explicitly, the world's not a static entity that remains in one state, but rather one which evolves. Hit patchut. And it, by the way, today it's the 21st century, right? It's 24, yeah, we're good. So it's not so edgy, at least in the world that we live in, when you have a rabbi who wears a kapota and has a big beard and has a shrimal and Shabbos, who uses a phrase like, right? The world isn't static. Eino olam davar omed al matzav echad. It doesn't stand in one state. Ki'im holechu umitpateach. Rather, it actually evolves. But you need to appreciate that in the early 20th century, for a religious figure to stand up and say that the world evolves, edged on heresy. Right? Darwin publishes the Origin of Species in 1859, I believe. And it took a while before the sort of implications, not just like the whole creation evolution thing, which, you know, may or may not be so challenging, but just simply the implications for human consciousness and general knowledge, right? In history, who was the great sort of adopter of the evolutionary stance? Well, Spencer was more in the sociology realm, but Hegel would be probably the... So, and if people are familiar with Hegel's thought, will always see resonance in Rav Kook, right? The sense that... Now, be wary here, because Rav Kook has a teleology in his notion of evolution. What do I mean? A little bit of explanation, right? Teleology means that things are going somewhere. That's the simplistic explanation, right? Any evolutionary biologist who exists in the academy will insist vehemently that there's no such thing in evolution. It's a great essay, if you ever want. You can Google it, probably. Stephen Jay Gould was one of the great evolutionary paleontologists. I think he was an evolutionary paleontologist. He studied the rock record of the 20th century. Jew. He used to write a lot of articles in the New York Times, which have been collected in books, which are highly readable. I encourage you to read them. And he has an essay called The Left-Hand Wall Theory. It's his argument against teleology in evolution. The classic teleology in evolution is that all of evolution was leading up to what? Me, right? Like, complex life. And biblically, it's like very tempting, because like you read the first chapter of Bereshit, it's like, there was nothing, and then there was light, and then there were fishes, and then there were birds, and then there was Adam. It's like a very sort of hierarchical, linear presentation, which, not surprisingly, puts the author squarely at the center of the universe, right? So, but he says that, you know, life is like a drunk staggering down the street with his hand on the left wall, right? That left-hand wall, he says, is single-cell organism, which always was, is, and will be the vast majority of life. He says, periodically, what happens to the drunk? He stumbles and he ends up in the gutter. He's like, that's complicated life. That's what happens. He's like, eventually, every once in a while, something goes blah and gets spit out, which is complex life. So he says, don't be so full of yourself in thinking that just because you can read my book and your average amoeba cannot, that you are the inevitable product of evolution. But that being said, obviously, Rav Kook has a very different perspective. He's not a paleontologist. He is a rabbi, right? And so he for sure sees humanity as an inevitable expression, although you can complicate that with his attitude on the potential for consciousness and animals, etc., that vision that I mentioned earlier. And one thing I'll tell you for sure is that that level, that position in creation comes with quite a bit of responsibility. But here, for him to embrace evolution as an assumption, right, is both historically and culturally and theologically, is critical. And in fact, his letters are some of the earliest engagement of an Orthodox rabbi with the concept of evolution in a formal scientific sense. He's got a few letters on the topic, worth reading if you ever get the chance. But here his whole point is that the world evolves, therefore true whole evolution brings it inexorably to complete health, material and spiritual, which brings with it the light of the life of tshuva. Now notice, as he pointed out, once you have a healthy, in our first text, healthy body, healthy heart in Emuna, comes this right consciousness. In this model, right consciousness is expressed by what? The sense of tshuva. And now, tshuva no longer has to do with deviation. You see what he's pushing away? He's like, okay, fine. There's a physical way the world has to work. Whether it's me personally, I don't need to be eating Ben and Jerry's. Whether it's the world sociopolitically, we should beat our swords into plowshares, right? And focus on feeding ourselves and not killing each other, right? However, whatever scale you want, or Am Yisrael should be a people in its land, right? Whatever scale you want to work on, but what the inevitable result in his eyes is right consciousness. But right consciousness ultimately means this light of tshuva. Now, what does that mean? If I'm now physically healthy and spiritually healthy, and now what? What role could tshuva possibly play? I'm not doing anything wrong. You hear the question? Right? This is a very, it underlies what we were speaking about before the class. It's this very positive attitude on tshuva. Because if you assume that mercy is simply a response to failure and is basically a bidyeved, it's a second best, and the world has just deviated from what it ought to have been, then there's nothing intrinsically positive about tshuva except in the fact that God didn't leave us out in the cold. But if you assume that tshuva actually is fundamental and therefore failure is built into creation as a positive, then there's something else offered by this light of tshuva.
So what are partners in creation?
Yes, junior partners.
That never ends.
Uh-huh. Great, let's keep going with that. Let's keep going with it. Yes. Yes, and we'll give him his words, because I would like to, yeah, I think we can do it. We might even be able to finish this whole section. So he says, the spirit of tshuva hovers over the world. I'm in section four here, right? And in Hebrew, the phrase might sound a little more familiar. Ruach tshuva mirachef ba'olam. What's the ruach mirachef? Yeah. Right. The Ruach Elohim mirachefet al hamayim. Right, that the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep. It's one of those, you have to lower your voice when you say that. Right? What? First of all, in the Bible, that phrase, I'm right now in my class upstairs in Striving for the Divine, we're still in the first chapter, Bereishit, where we'll be for quite some time. And this, I'm telling you from experience of years of teaching this section, there's just no good answer for why the Bible, the second line. First line is very clear. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Like, fine, I get that. And then it's like, the Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the waters and the deep and the darkness. Like, where all this come from? What's going on here? Right? But I would say that Rav Kook here, to keep it at least on a comprehensible level, is responding to one of the explanations that the Midrash offers. That the Midrash offers and says that it was actually the Spirit of the Mashiach. It's the Spirit of the Messiah. That when it says, Ruach Elohim mirhefet al pnei amayim, that Ruach Elohim is the spirit of the Messiah. Okay. Sounds nice. How does that explain what Rav Kook means? Because the spirit of tshuva hovers over the world, giving its essential character and driving its evolution. Here's the real teleology. Driving its evolution. Meaning what? Mashiach is the same as Shabbos. In fact, anybody ever listens to any good Reb Shlomo, you know that he focuses on the great Shabbos, which of course is a rabbinic concept. It's not his, but I mean, why is Mashiach like Shabbos? What do we say about Shabbos? Sof maaseh b'machshava chila. That it was the last act, but it was the first thought. Meaning that Shabbat is not just the reason for which the world was created, because if it were the reason for which the world was created, once Shabbos came, what could you do with the world? Chuck it. Right? Right? But it is rather the 6 days of creation are that from which Shabbat emerges. Right? As the Maharal says, there are six experiential directions. In front, behind, left, right, up, down. Where's the seventh? It's right in the middle. It's wherever you are. And notice that you can't really know where that seventh is until you define the previous six. Right? But the seventh is actually the center point. It's what gives them all their union. Correct, but you don't know where it is until you define the other six. In the same way, Shabbat emerges out of the 6 days of the week. In a simpler sense, I bet we've all had the experience of a Shabbat which comes after a week of vacation and one which comes after a week of work. Which there are different types of experiences. Sometimes the one that comes after a week of vacation is really great. But there's something, I think, more profound about the 6 days of work and this, and by the way, not just 6 days of work, but also the fact that there's going to be another first day of work coming. Now, I know for me, the highest moments of Shabbat always come when it's at Suda Shashit and my kids are saying, Dad, can we bench and say Abdallah? And I say, I have so much work to do. I'm not in any hurry. They're like, why start now? Right? It doesn't happen often, but that's when I know that I've got a little bit of Shabbat. In the same way, Mashiach is there, say the sages. But it's not like the whole world exists for Mashiach and then we can chuck it. That's a Christian theology. which is, see how close it is, but they were Yotzei Beit Midrash. They did come from rabbinic culture. It's, what? He was always there. The world is just like this thing that you got to get over. The body is the prison of the soul. Having children is giving fruit to death. These are quotes, right? These are Pauline scripture quotes in particular, because it's a very particular attitude on these questions, right? What we're saying is that, there cannot be Mashiach without the world. It's true that the Mashiach is the fruit that the world bears, but you can't have product without process. If you reach out and just take the fruit without the tree, well, we know that story, right? It doesn't end well, right? The alienation of product from process, elsewhere Rav Kook speaks about, is one of the fundamental sins of creation, right? And so therefore, the tshuva hovers over the world, it gives its essential character, drives its evolution. But tshuva only comes from what? Practically speaking, what's the first step in tshuva? Sin and failure, deviation, right? You see how this is a consistent theme. The only way things can evolve is through failure, which, by the way, evolutionary biology agrees. The idea of selective advantage, this is whatever, however you understand it, but selective advantage only comes into play if there's some force in the world which is trying to wipe you out, right? And then some creature has some selective advantage that allows it to reproduce at some slightly higher rate, and next thing you know, you get speciation and the whole thing. If you don't, you guys don't know evolutionary biology, that's fine. But you get my point, that without the pressure, there can't be evolution. Yes. Not only that, the word for sin in Hebrew is chet, and what does it actually mean? It means to miss the mark. Those are two different things. On a moral language level, chet means to deviate from the plan, right? But if you ever watch a basketball game in Hebrew, you'll realize that chet actually wichti, right? It just means to miss the mark. Right? And you see how there's a fundamentally different theology from that flows from that? Right? Missing the mark means, okay, but I know there's a mark. And if you think about it, anybody in this room who feels like they've accomplished something in this life, I promise you, part of that was failure. Was accomplished something that you consider to be profound and meaningful to you, you failed at least once. It's inevitable. Why? Because it wouldn't be so precious and meaningful to you. You wouldn't have that deep sense of ownership if you hadn't had to overcome. And also, by the way, most of us, our first thoughts aren't our best ones. Right? It's the process of iteration of, I'm going to try it, and then I'm going to try it again. Right? And I'm going to try it again. Right? And that's where the best of us comes out. And so if Cook says, yeah, that's called tshuva. Not tshuva in the sense of you blew it and nebuch and okay, says God, I'll let you have a second chance. But tshuva in the sense of that's why I created the world. We still haven't quite gotten to his explanation of why the vessels couldn't hold. But I hope you start to see they're starting to come together. All right, we got to, good, we're going to do this. You guys ready? Questions or comments up to now before I just keep barreling ahead? No, it's okay. It doesn't have to be a fully formed one. It can also be what? Okay. We'll keep. So now he's going to engage what actually is, I think, one of our greatest challenges for all of us. I have to look at this one in the Hebrew. He says, "Na'akshenut lamod tami b'de'ah echad." Right? The stubborn need to always stand in one opinion. And de'ah is opinion's a fair translation, but de'ah also is one mode of consciousness. Remember, consciousness is not what you know, it's how you know. This has never been more clear than in the social media age, that an opinion is actually a frame for existence. Right? I remember when the stabbing intifada, Shinlo Nedam Yizeh, was going on. At this point, it's been a couple of years. And the daughter-in-law of Rav Fruman, his daughter-in-law was stabbed. She's pregnant. Thank God she was okay and the baby was okay. But they interviewed her husband afterwards. And he said, this proves what? that we have to find a way to live with the people around us. Meanwhile, he's got neighbors who are saying that this guy burst into this woman's secondhand clothing shop, stabbed a pregnant woman. This proves what? These people are animals and we have to get rid of them, right? Both of which together prove what? That everybody sees the world as a support for what they already believe. And that's one of the great dangers that prevents growth. Right? So he says, the akshanut, the stubbornness of standing in one dea, one opinion, one way of knowing the world, litamech ba b'chav le'achet she'nasu l'minyag, and to use it as a support for staying bound up in the sin which has become one's custom. Right? I told you that everybody wants to turn their bad behavior into an ideology in order to feel good about what they're doing. This is what he just said, right? Ben b'masim ben b'deo. And by the way, he says, whether that's an action or it's a way of knowing the world, if you're stuck and you need, and you're the way you know the world is helping you do or see the world in ways that are wrong or bad or harmful, hi machala haba mitoch shakub avdut kasheh. This is a sickness that comes from being deeply sunk in a very difficult slavery. Now, avdut is a loaded word for Rav Kook. I'll finish and then we'll take it apart a little bit. Which won't allow the light of tshuva to sort of to shine forth in its true brilliance, in its real brilliance. Because tshuva longs, it thirsts for a sort of like a deep, true source freedom. It's the godly freedom which has with it no slavery. Now, a word on Rav Kook and freedom, which is a big sugya, so we're not going to go into it all the way. It's important to understand what's the word for being religious in Yiddish is what? Frum. And when the Frummers used to see the sort of like children of the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, walking through the streets, what did they call them?
Fry.
Which means what? Means free. Right? Because that was the Yiddish equivalent of what we in Hebrew call porke ol. Right? They had thrown off the yoke of heaven. So it deserves some thought if Rav Kook is coming from a culture, in fact, not just coming from, but living within a rabbinic culture, which sees freedom as the antithesis of religion, and how on earth can he, not only here, but elsewhere, will insist that actually freedom is the Tzelem Elohim in the human being. It is the image of God within you. He just said this is godly freedom. How could he do such a thing? So a little bit of a sort of a intellectual history note, it's important to just to know that there are two ways in which you can grow through opposition. Right? Right? The classic way is conflict. If you look at the Haredish world today, which is getting bad press, unfortunately, some of it they deserve, but getting bad press nonetheless, and we should have empathy for every Jew. But the Haredi world has successfully chosen the path of growth through conflict. What do I mean? The reformim, the seculars, the Mechalei Shabbos, right? If you've ever gone down, Hashem Yishmor, to when the women of the wall have their services on Rosh Chodesh, you can see the power available in growth through conflict. Because the Haredi world, whatever you may think of them, is thriving right now. They're thriving. They got tremendous energy. They got tremendous political power. Like a culture which is, I mean, it's like, I'm not saying it's perfect. There's all kinds of problems in every culture. But my point is, and that happened through opposition. A clear enemy is a tremendous source of growth. We know it from a lot of the history of nationalism, et cetera. This is not unfamiliar. You guys understand? The other model of growth through opposition is the dialectic. Is that when I find something which opposes me, I figure out what it is particularly that presses upon me. And that which presses upon me means that there's something in it which is available to me which I couldn't find in myself. Right? And therefore, by engaging that which I oppose, as opposed to being in conflict with it, and then making it part of who I am, I become something new. So when Rav Kook encountered the classic thoughts of modernity, particularly freedom, which individual freedom is one of the hallmarks of modernity, right? He said, on one hand, this is an opposition. The Torah is a binding covenant. I don't really care whether you feel like praying today, says Rav Kook. And he is the halachic authority of the land of Israel at this point. He is not what today would be termed as a liberal or progressive. In many ways, he's a conservative in law. Nevertheless, he says, there is something in this which is fundamental to Torah, which we have not brought out yet. And it's through that oppositional energy, right, that he then co-opts this notion of freedom and puts it forward as the fundamental characteristic, not just of humanity in the secular world, but of the divine within the human within the religious world. It's a radical shift. And here he gives you a classic example of it. Slavery means what? The inability to grow and change. Right? That's a big assertion which deserves to be digested. Right? He didn't say anything about mitzvot here. Let's go with it. Although I think there's important truth in what you're saying. He says that holding fast to one opinion and using it to support oneself in sin, right, is a disease that results from the immersion in harsh servitude. Now, avdut is funny because, you know, avdut means slavery, but we also use it in another way. We talk about avodat Hashem. And then what's the translation?
Service.
Right. This is the big place where a lot of Jewish culture, certainly secular Jewish culture, but I think religious Jewish culture as well, in its own opposite way, has failed to understand the Pesach story. We were slaves in Egypt and we came out to what?
Servitude.
Right. So, well, not servitude. It's not a story of slavery to freedom. It's a story of servitude to service. Right? Now, what's the difference between servitude and service? Is the difference between what we call avodah zara, which is what? Idolatry, and avodat Hashem, which is divine service. But avodah zara literally means what? Strange service. Meaning it's something which is alien to you. Everybody's had this experience. Everybody ever have a job that you didn't like, you didn't want, and the only reason you were doing it is because you needed to earn money? We've all done that. I'm assuming, unless you're very fortunate, right? That's servitude. Why? Because you're completely alienated from what you're doing. All you're interested is in the product. Ooh, that sounds familiar. All you're interested in is the product. Okay, you could say it's an inevitable part of life or whatever, but it's still servitude. Anybody ever have a job that when you woke up in the morning to go to work, you said, yes, this is what I want to do today? Isn't it also what you have to do today? Because if you don't do it, you're not going to get earn the money and you won't be able to feed your family? Yes. What's the difference between the two of them? You identify with the process as well as the product. Right? And therefore, it's no longer strange to you. And it's not an act of servitude. It's an act of service. Even though it can often be very demanding. Even though sometimes you don't even like it. Let's be honest. Nobody likes their job every single moment or every piece of it. Right? But if I feel that as a whole, that I'm in service of, as opposed in service, in servitude, then okay, the product can be important. We all got to make a living, and maybe you want to be rich. Great. But that's the product is not the purpose. There's not that alienation between product and process, which is always the hallmark of servitude. It's always the hallmark also of idolatry. Right? The idolater doesn't want an intimate relationship with God that allows them to become who they are. They are either afraid of what's going to happen and they're appeasing, or they want something they can't get by themselves and they're bribing or twisting the arm. Right? So when Rav Kook here says that the stubborn insistence of holding fast to one opinion in order to support myself, when I transform my bad behaviors into an ideology, what do I deny myself the potential to do? Yeah. And therefore, there's no tshuva. Not because God won't let you, because you actually have convinced yourself that what you're doing is right. Then you can't grow. There's no tshuva. That's it. You're stuck. And you're in servitude to whom? Yourself. Right? Which is why he then says, Tshuva thirsts for true essential liberation, right? The divine liberation that allows for no subjugation, but it does allow for service. And service is based on relationship, right? There's a relationship model that lies behind so much of what we're speaking about here. Now go back to this image of the Chalal HaPanui, that empty space that the Arizal says was the first act of creation, right? Why is that critical? Because you cannot have relationship without separation. All relationship, the necessary precursor is separation, which is strange. You know, today we talk about othering. It's like the ultimate sin. At least it is in the millennial crowd upstairs, right? It is the ultimate sin, but I'm very fond of pointing out to my students is that without othering, you have no relationship. Othering, there's no relationship, right? Meaning you can't have love, you can't have intimacy, you can't have growth in the challenge that come from, by the way, the model of relationship in the Torah is summed up in God says, what's the ultimate not good? It's not good to be alone. Lo tov hiyot adam levado. Now follow the logic. The one question that you can't find explicitly answered in the Torah in creation is why? Why creation? Except there's a very simple logic. Humanity is created in the image of God, correct? Yeah? And God says it's not good for humanity to be alone, right? Therefore, it's not good for God to be alone. Oh, so now you know why creation. Now here's the problem, is if God creates a creature which is completely reflective of God's will, you know what God is? Alone. You ever have a productive relationship with someone who agrees with everything you said? No. No. Because there's an element in the relationship which is ezer kenegdo. Right? God says it's not good for Adam to be alone. Creates Chava, you know, who, according to the rabbis, they were already created together, if you're familiar with the rabbinic myth, that they were created back to back. And then God splits off Chava. Notice the difference in theology. If Chava's made from a rib, you know what she is? Completely superfluous. You don't need your ribs. She's literally an useless appendage there to serve him. But if Chava was half of him, you know, God splits them off, right? And this Adam says what when he meets her? Ha pa'am, basam bisarai, etzem atzmai, right? Flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone. And then there's a very interesting narrative shift in the text, right? It says, al kein yazov ish et aviv ve'imo, like the narrative voice kind of like sticks in there. It's like, therefore, man will abandon his mother and father, who we've never heard of before because Adam and Chava don't have a mother and father, but fine, right? And will cleave to his wife and become one flesh, which according to the sages, they in the begin with. Oh, because separation is always the necessary precursor to the relationship. You know what the difference between Adam and Chava before and Adam and Chava after is? It's the difference between a back-to-back and a face-to-face relationship. Right? That act of separation is what creates real relationship. And so God creates space. Space is a place where humanity can come to be something other than God. Oh, interesting. The first place that Adam asserts his will is in doing what? Well, missing the mark. Not doing what he was told, or actually doing what he was not told. Or he was told, sorry, doing what he was told not to do, right? You know what I think the real failure, the real sin in Eden was? It wasn't eating the fruit. And it wasn't listening to his wife. You know what it was? Blaming someone else. Just imagine what would have happened if God had said, Adam, did you eat from that tree I told you not to? And Adam had said, well, listen, we got to talk because this is much bigger than I thought. A completely different creation. Because now Adam has taken responsibility for his actions and entered into a deeper relationship. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't be your own being and then as soon as you are faced with the consequences of your own actions, deny and blame someone else. That shows Adam's not ready, so he's got to leave and go about the rest of history until the point where he's able to do what? Be an independent creature who takes responsibility for their actions. You know what we call that? A healthy relationship. Because you don't want a relationship with people who don't take responsibility for their actions. You don't want a relationship with people who don't have agency. Anybody here who has children, please God, also has adult children who they have a very different relationship to than when they were infants, toddlers, or teenagers. Right? Because at a certain point, every parent has to look at their child as an adult, and hopefully children also look at their parents as human beings. And that's a fundamental, that's just an act of separation that allows for a different mode of relationship. You see the theme here? And here's the thing. If sin, missing the mark, is always just a failure, then all you could ever hope to get back to is an infantile relationship. Once it was perfect, you listened to everything I said. And then you stopped listening to me. So now what I'd like to fix our relationship is you now listen to everything I say. Who wants that relationship with a 30-year-old? You don't want obedience. You know, you raise your children to certain values, and ultimately what you want is for them to be human beings who do what's right because they believe it's right, not because you told them to. That's what it is to be a human being. It's the same story here. So the divine freedom that Rav Kook is speaking about is a liberation which allows for no subjugation. Doesn't mean you have to keep the rules. He's into the rules. I mean, he wants you to keep the rules because you identify with them, not because you were told what to do. Right? Now, historically speaking, there's a place for being a child. It's not like he's saying, if you don't identify with it, don't do it. By the way, you can see where that goes in our culture today. He's saying, no, if you don't identify with it, do it, but you're going to struggle because there will always be a bit of slavery in it. And his belief, his optimism, you don't have to share it, but his optimism is that if you do so, if you are healthy in body and healthy in heart, that ultimately you will be able to see that this is indeed not only what's right, but it's who you could be. That there's a you that can emerge through that relationship, which is not there yet. So let's see if we can finish the last couple ones out. This is, now he speaks to, oh, we're never going to finish it. We'll do what we can, and then I'll figure out how to end the last class neatly. Don't worry, that's my job. He says, without the thought of tshuva, life is crushing. And not in the sense of, it's interesting. Somebody mentioned this idea of the Christian notion of salvation, right? You can see in the Gemara, there's a dialogue with Rabbi Yochanan, if I'm not mistaken, about a heretic, which often the Gemara is referring to the early Christians, who comes to Rabbi Yochanan and basically says that, your altar is gone. What are you going to do now, Rabbi? Because if you look on the face of it, biblical theology, what brings atonement? Yeah, blood on the altar. And you know what the Christians said? His blood will make you clean. Anybody here ever heard that phrase? If you haven't lived in the southern United States, you may not have heard it before, but I've heard it plenty of times. Meaning that's the image in Christianity that Jesus of Nazareth was the last sacrifice. And therefore, without belief in that notion, you're stuck in sin. That the only way to gain atonement, since as a human being, you're a failed project, you can't do it on your own, the only way is through sacrifice. So in the Old Testament religion, right? That's another one of those deep voice things, right? So you had the actual sacrifice, but the Jews were wrong. We didn't understand the truth of our scripture, and then God sent the last sacrifice, blah, blah, blah. Except, what's Rabbi Yochanan's answer? No, it's tshuva. It's tshuva. And not just tshuva in the sense of, like, whew, I'm sure glad the points aren't racking up against me in heaven, I can fix that. But it's a deeper theology, which is that, oh, you mean that those sins weren't just like new, bad, bad, bad failure, but they're indicative, as we've now seen, of a fundamentally different potential in the world? So he says, without the thought of tshuva, the comfort and security it brings, you can't find rest and spiritual life can never evolve. Why not? Because the moral sense demands of humanity justice, goodness, wholeness. Have you ever wondered about that? I don't think there's a society in the world, at least not one I'm familiar with, there probably are, but I'm not an anthropologist, that doesn't have a sense of wholeness, some vision of what the world either could be or should be, right? Where does such a thing come from? I mean, we've never seen it in history. We certainly don't see it in society. From whence the optimism that the world could actually be whole? I mean, the pessimistic worldview is much more, what? it's easy, and also on the surface of it, it's a little bit easier to prove. I mean, like, okay, the world is going to the toilet, right? Fine. But I would argue, by the way, it's an indication of spiritual evolution, right? That it is an evolutionary advantage to know that the world could be whole. Why? Because otherwise, life is crushing, as Will Cook says. Because the reality is, you're never going to make it. He does the double. The fact that you believe the world could be whole, Mela, that's, you know, because God told you so. But you know what the problem is? It's not. Not only is it not, but you have a deep sense, it never will be. Because we're always failing, he says. How weak is our ability to set our actions upon the pure foundations of complete ideal justice? How can we possibly long for that which is entirely out of our reach? It seems awfully cruel for God to give us a notion, either built in or revealed or however you think of it, that the world could be perfect and then basically laugh for the rest of history as we struggle and fail to get there. But this is a very important piece, which with, I guess, we're going to wrap up, which is the word for wholeness in Hebrew is what? Shlemut. Shlemut, right? Which is a static state. Something which is shalem, whole, that's it. And you know what? Such a thing does not exist in our world at all. Living systems, get rid of them all. There's no such thing as a whole living system. Living systems are constant flux, dying, growing, inevitably dying. You know what the leading cause of death is, right? Birth. This is part of the package, right? Physical systems, nope. If they're rocks, they're eroding. If there's energy, it's dissipating, right? And I'm waiting to the day that my daughter understands the notion of entropy and then can use it as an excuse not to clean her room like I did in high school, right? I mean, what's the point? You're just fighting nature, right? We don't have such a thing. There's no notion of wholeness in our world. But there is another difference, another concept, which is hishtalmut. What's that mean? Don't say professional development, which is what it is in modern Hebrew. Hishtalmut is the process of becoming whole, right? You know, when we talk about, people are often bothered about creation. I mean, some people are. They say, God is perfect. How could the world be so broken? Did that ever bother anybody? Right? One answer to that is the world is an expression of that aspect of God's perfection, which is not static, but rather dynamic. The world is a process of hishtalmut. The only perfection in the world is that which is constantly striving to perfect. And you can see how this becomes then a consistent image going all the way back to that creating of space, which is the source of all brokenness and ugliness, says God, says Rav Cook, sorry, right? That richuk, that distance from God. You know, the word for evil in Hebrew is what? Ra. And what's the word for friend? Yeah, you can actually pronounce that two different ways. Ra and Rea. It's because separation is either the source of all evil or the source of all relationship. You choose. That's what God said. I'm going to create a world where there's space between you and I. And you can either make that a source of pain, ugliness, distance, or you can make it a source of relationship. That's what it is to be human, right? And that's going to be a constant struggle, says Ralph Cook. It never stops. And so therefore, how can that not be depressing? He says, tshuva. But not tshuva as, you know, we're going to make up for your failures. But that's why I created the world, said God. Watch this. Tshuva means repent, but also means return, right? So picture this. God says it's not good to be alone. So God makes that space, takes creation, and basically tosses it out there. Away from me, says God. There's only one good thing that can come from that. What is it? It's desire to return. Because that desire is the foundation of all relationship. If you think about it, relationships that don't demand anything from you are not particularly satisfying. Easy come, easy go. Right? Anybody here ever had someone they were once friends with? Right. Sometimes that's logistical, circumstantial, and we miss that, right? Other times it's because, okay, so that was like, we were friends, and then we're not. Not no nasty breakup, no ugliness, just like, yeah. Yeah. But the friends that we've invested in, are the ones who really matter to us, the ones who've challenged us and who've helped us become and asked us to be more than we were. So I'll just end on this last note in the last minute, that Rav Cook has a fantastic answer for why the vessels couldn't hold. It's simple and very profound. I got to tell you, the first time I read it, I literally danced in the Beit Midrash. He says, you have to know one thing. God doesn't hold back. See, if God had only given according to the capacity of the world to receive, then we'd be stuck in this world where tshuva would always be getting back to some what once was. He says, but God doesn't hold back. God gave to the full goodness of God, and by definition, the world can't receive that. So the world breaks. You know why the world breaks? In order that we can put it back together. And by putting it back together, we become what he calls the bore and not the nivra. We're creators ourselves and not just passive creations. And in doing that, we're able to receive far more than we ever would have been able to if God had only given according to our capacity to receive. Now, on one hand, that hurts. The world breaks. It's ugly. The world's a very broken place. On the other hand, it's what allows us to actually receive more than we could ever imagine, and therefore enter into a bore-bore relationship, a creator-to-creator. The greatness of God is not in creating subjects in the sense of subjugation, but creating subjects in the literary sense, that we're actually actors in our own right in the world. And then entering into a free relationship with God is where the real power of creation comes. And as you've seen now, in Rav Kook's mind, that depends on the power of tshuva. So we're going to stop there, because it's time, and we'll pick up with the last class next week.
This was a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To learn more about sponsoring a podcast, please contact Jamie at pardes.org.